Howdy.
Sup.
Howdy, howdy, howdy. I'm Leisha.
That's Leisha.
That's Jules.
And I'm Jules.
And this is a Screen Tea Podcast. Eventually, we're just going to devolve to shouting podcast at the beginning.
That's L, the J,
T. That's how we're going to wind up starting.
Eventually. Yeah, it's just going to be T, music, then.
T, music, movies, done.
This is going to be a 15-second podcast,
even though our intro music's like 30 seconds long. It's going to be a 33-second podcast. Yeah. Tonight's episode will not be a 33-second podcast, however.
No.
Nah. How you be?
Tired.
Yeah.
Shocker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm exhausted.
I know you are. You always are. You don't ever sleep.
Surprise.
Not surprised.
I have actually been, like, disappointing myself lately with how little sleep I get.
Wow.
I know, that's impressive. I'm pretty sure this is the worst it's ever been.
Wow.
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 Okay, Owen, calm down. Yeah, just getting like 3.5 to 4.5 hours a night every night consistently since the semester started. I'm going on, this is my 5th week of this.
How many more weeks you got left?
3.
That's not bad.
I have this week and 2 more weeks, and then the semester of hell will be done. I can see colors. It's not fun.
You can see colors, you can hear colors.
Point.
Editing around your laughs is a fun task.
Why do it?
Sometimes it doesn't sound good because you peak the mic with your whatever it is you do.
Was that what I sound like?
No, that was terrible.
So sorry.
You just have that really high inhale.
I can see colors actually every day of my life.
You are not, in fact, colorblind.
No. That's just a fact I decided to share today, this moment in time. It has nothing to do with the fact that I'm tired. Anyway, what you drinking?
Citrus rose tea.
Citrus rose tea.
I know it says tea.
Does it really?
It's T-E with a thing above the E.
The accent you?
I don't know.
It's a thing.
It's a thing.
I have me some pumpkin spice black tea and it is delicious.
It smells good.
Even though I think it's a white girl sin to drink pumpkin spice out of October.
I don't understand that phenomenon. Just fucking drink what you want to fucking drink.
Yeah.
Like,
we talked about this the other day, and we decided the answer to why is this a thing is consumerism, just like everything else in America.
Capitalism.
Well, capitalism, consumerism, both. Hand in hand, besties.
I want that on a shirt.
That's funny. But yeah, pumpkin spice is the best.
I mean, yeah, it's a yummy thing.
I like it a lot better than peppermint, which tends to be like Christmas season bullshit.
I love anything mint.
Yeah.
I think peppermint, I think I like spearmint the least.
And I like spearmint the most.
Interesting.
Like peppermint.
I might be getting my mints mixed up.
I think you like peppermint the most.
Yeah, yeah. I really like minty things a lot.
No, Christmas time is when I get like that. I like chestnut, praline, and like eggnog flavors and brandy.
Definitely
always.
Not.
but no, I don't dig like the peppermint theme of all of the drinks around this time of year. It makes me miss the pumpkin.
Mm.
But I got the pumpkin here, and that's all that matters.
And we bought it, so you can drink it whatever until you run out.
He is like, hey, I should have bought 75,000 of them.
Whoa.
That's a lot.
Calm down. We don't have room for that many boxes.
That's what you think. This is a big house. We could have an entire room just for 75,000 satchels of pumpkin spice black tea.
I didn't say satchels, I said boxes, because you have to buy them by the box.
Well.
Continue on.
My point still stands, methinks. Anyway, it's been a minute, so I just wanted to take a second to give a shout-out to WatershedVoice.com, who's still featuring us weekly on their digital newspaper on their website. So please go check them out. Support local journalism. That would be amazing. They support us. We support them. And before we jump in to the thing, I have a question for you, Jules. And do you know what it is?
What is it?
It's this week's real question.
Oh.
You weren't ready, were you?
No.
You want to know what's hilarious? I just realized I haven't thought of my answer yet. Oh, shit.
Y'all should see the look that I am giving her.
It is unamused while kind of amused at the same time.
While very tired.
While very tired and a little bit over my shit already. And I have lots of pages of writing for this episode. Now she looks exhausted.
Jesus. I had to deal with a very willful child all day. I am tired of everyone's shit.
Man, I'd have switched you. I would have switched you so
yeah,
hard.
We've discussed how well me being a therapist would go.
You know what? I say that a lot, but that's a lie. I really like spending time with my clients.
I know you do.
It's just the days are so long.
Yeah.
That's the deal. The days are so long.
Yeah.
You know what? How about I ask you the question, you read me people's answers while I choose mine.
Dumb.
What is your favorite Adam Driver movie?
This question.
Okay, you know what? This question, I'm still pissed about this question.
Look up your answer. Gosh darn it.
Gosh darn it. Do you want to tell the people why I'm pissed because of the experience that you had asking people this question?
Nobody. Well, that's not true. My original, hesitation came from nobody knowing who Adam Driver is or was.
Mm.
Which turned out to be nobody knows who he is outside of the Star Wars movies.
Mm.
So they know who he is. They just haven't seen him in anything outside of those.
Mm.
But we got 3 votes for Black Klansman, which is a phenomenal movie.
Mm-hmm.
We got 2 for Star Wars The Last Jedi. We got 1 for Logan Lucky. We have 1 for Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker. And then we have 1 for This Is Where I Leave You.
And what's yours? What's your favorite Adam Driver movie?
I keep coming back to Marriage Story.
Fuck yeah, I'm going to have to agree with you.
Because that's just a phenomenal, depressing movie.
It's so good.
But it's very well acted and written and directed. And that's just a really, really good movie. And I keep, Black Klansman almost had my vote. But I just, and then The Dead Don't Die, I was like, oh. But I just kept coming back to Marriage Story.
Yeah, Marriage Story, I just pulled up the IMDb and I knew there wasn't anything that was going to pop out at me, even though I had my moment of going through his filmography and watched just about damn everything. But I knew it was going to be Marriage Story. I don't know why I checked. Because if not Marriage Story, it's probably this. It's probably the movie that we covered this week. And then if we're talking about Adam Driver roles specifically, I would probably say The Rise of Skywalker.
Mm. Yeah.
In taking a step out of film, Girls, he's just such a fucker in Girls.
I caught episodes with you here and there, but I didn't really pay attention to that.
He's an asshole, but he has such a great character arc and a lot of character growth. He still doesn't wind up being a phenomenal person, but it's really interesting to watch him grow. I think as an actor as well in that role over the
years.
That
was one of his kind of first big ones, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what he was known for at the beginning. And then we've seen him in a couple of really interesting roles. We saw him as the super country singer in Inside Llewyn Davis, the Oscar Isaac movie.
Yeah, I have a vague recollection of that movie.
That was when I was on my Oscar Isaac kick, and it was just bonus Adam Driver. Hey, hey, hey. And then that Hungry Hearts film. The one where the mother, like, doesn't feed the child, the baby.
Vague recollection of
that. We own that one.
Yeah.
But yeah, Marriage Story, because he and Scarlett Johansson just are, it's two of the finest just moments of acting or roles I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've obviously seen, to take a quick tangent, seen Scarlett Johansson in the Marvel Universe and some other movies, a lot of, some of which are garbage.
Yep.
And some of which are really good, but then you see her in this and it's just like, who the fuck is this?
Right, Where the hell did she come from?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Like, she's phenomenal.
Yeah.
All of her previous work, I think for the most part, would never lead you to assume that she could perform like that.
Absolutely. You just said it in the best way possible. Mm-hmm. And Adam, like, his performance surprised me less, I think, because I've seen him in more serious roles. Not that her roles aren't serious, but in more well-written roles than I've seen Scarlett. But he still managed to take me by surprise. Like, he still managed to move me to fucking tears with his performance in that film as well. So did she.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hard watch. It's a good watch. It's just a good
movie. It's a real watch.
Absolutely, yeah. like, you can't convince me that they weren't secretly married for years and then got divorced on set of this
movie. Like, that was the research that they did for this movie. They actually got married, had a kid, and then they basically just filmed their lives. It was like, what is it, like a boy, whatever. That
Boyhood.
Boyhood. That's what they did.
God. Obviously, that's bullshit, but that's what it felt like. Like, it felt so genuine. And there were a couple, like, yeah, the fact that people don't know his roles as much, it's really disappointing to me, because he is a fucking star. He is amazing. He has to be one of the best actors of this generation. And you're even, like, nodding your head, and I don't think you and I always agree, but I just...
I mean, he's certainly, at the very least, a contender. A strong, strong contender.
Yeah. Yep.
So...
Yeah, he's mind-blowing. And then, yeah, just to think of some of his goofier, like Logan Lucky, I often forget how it's a goofy movie. But it was a good movie. He was good in that movie, too. I enjoyed him in that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's just, you know, he is one of the first things that I fell in love with in this generation of Star Wars, was he as Kylo.
Mm-hmm.
What did you refer to him as in your Discord group?
The Broodmaster.
The Broodmaster. Aww.
Am I wrong?
No.
Yeah.
The adorable Broodmaster. He's so cute and non-threatening and just adorable and so misguided. And I love him and just, once again, want to hug him and therapize the shit out of Kylo Ren. It's like a dream. Yeah.
Ben Solo. Your
yes.
little doodle from this angle looks like a dog.
Oh, and I was thinking about a crab claw when I doodled it.
Okay.
From my perspective. I hope you're all imagining what my doodle looks like. A dog from one end, a crab claw from the other.
It's a really wide crab claw.
It is a fat ass like crab claw.
Or it's like a fish or a whale. Anyway. Sorry.
Let's continue, shall we?
Let's get on with this show.
All right. So, I've been really excited to do this episode, mainly because this was a film that I tried to show Juliet years ago that she had no interest in. And I didn't do it to torture her. I did it because I wanted her to watch it, because I think this is one of the finest films that I've seen in a long time. So, I'm really eager to hear how this is about to go. All right. This week, we watched Patterson, which was released in 2016 and directed by Jim Jarmusch, whose other notable films include Stranger Than Paradise, Only Lovers Left Alive, and The Dead Don't Die. Patterson was also written by Jim Jarmusch, with poems written by the poet Ron Padgett, and one poem written by the poet William Carlos Williams. That was read in the poem. The poem by the little girl in the film was, however, written by Jim Jarmusch as well. Other notable film credits for Jim Jarmusch for writing include Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai, Coffee and Cigarettes, and Broken Flowers, and the films mentioned above for direction.
Quick note. I've seen some of Coffee and Cigarettes for school.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. How is it?
I don't remember any of it. I actually watched the trailer and was like, I have a vague vague recollection of this. I forget what class it was even for, but I was just like, I was looking him up and I saw that and I was like, I've seen this. I've seen this cover. I've seen this one of these segments because it's a bunch of, like, it's like an anthology.
Oh, interesting.
It's a bunch of shorts that he, like, put together with a bunch of famous actors. So many famous actors.
I love when that happens.
Yeah, like, there's one segment that has Iggy Pop and Tom Waits.
Oh, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I was watching an interview earlier with Jim Jarmusch and Iggy Pop.
Yep.
So, yep. Very anyway. Cool. Patterson was produced by, here's a couple companies for you, K5 International. This is an Amazon Studios original. Inkjet Productions, Le Pact, and Animal Kingdom.
Some individuals that produced this were Joshua Astrachan, Daniel Bauer, Ron Bosman, Gene Labadie, Carter Logan, and Oliver Seinman.
Jesus Christ, we're laughing because that literally took her 5 minutes to read those names.
I'm going
to
cut that
No,
out.
You have to leave this.
No.
You have to leave some of this.
The DP was Frederick Elms. They're known for Eraserhead, Blue Velvet, and Horns. This is the original Blue Velvet.
Yes.
Yeah. The editor is Alfonso. Is that supposed to be Alfonso or Alfonso?
Alfonso.
Interesting. Alfonso Goncalves. They are known for the TV show True Detective, Carol, and Dark Waters. Damn.
Right? Right.
Damn. Music was by... original music was written and performed by Jim Jarmusch, Carter Logan, a.k.a. Squirrel, and some other notable... Music credits for Jim Jarmusch are Permanent Vacation, The State of Things, and some other music credits for Carter Logan, a.k.a. Squirrel, are The Limits of Control, Only Lovers Left Alive, and The Dead Don't Die.
Mm-hmm. Noise. Noise. So, a few stars of Patterson. Of course, we have Mr. Adam Driver, who plays Patterson. You know him as Kylo Ren from Star Wars, from Marriage Story, and the television show Girls. It's almost as though we just talked about all of these roles. We also have Golshifteh Farahani as Laura. You know her from About Ellie, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, and Genlock, which is a television show. We have Nellie the dog, who plays Marvin the dog. Nellie was in Legally Blonde, the musical, as a dog, I hope. We have Rizwan Manji playing Donnie. You know Rizwan from so many things, including Transformers, The Wolf of Wall Street, and the television show The Magicians.
It's funny that you didn't include Schitt's Creek.
I just, you know, I chose The Magicians as the TV show. What?
We have Barry Chewbacca Henley, who plays Doc. They're known for Rush Hour, Collateral, and the TV show Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And then we have Cheston Harmon, who plays Marie. They are known for the TV shows Damnation, Elementary, and The Fix. We have William Jackson Harper, who plays Everett. They are known for the TV show The Electric Company, Midsummer, and the TV show The Good Place.
Cheaty!
And finally, we have Masatoshi Nagase. They are known for Smuggler, Red Snow, and Sakura. They play the Japanese poet.
A few actors' notes from IMDb.com. I'm just going to read the IMDb mini biography for Nellie by David Sedman because I think it's super sweet. Broadway animal trainer William Berlone discovered Nellie at the Humane Society of New York in 2008 at 10 months of age. He worked with Nellie and she became a regular character in the National Road and regional touring shows of Legally Blonde the Musical. Those shows took her all over the country, including Los Angeles and Chicago, and she appeared in more than 700 consecutive shows, which no other actor had previously. A demonstration tape was made of Nellie, and she was selected to play the canine role in Patterson. During production, cancer was discovered, and the production schedule accommodated her health issues. Nellie died at age 8 after her shooting had already wrapped. She would be nominated for Best Dog Actor at Cannes in 2016 for her performance and became the first Palm Dog winner to receive the award posthumously. Producer Carter Logan accepted the prize, a golden collar, and urged folks who were inspired by Nellie's story to adopt a dog as opposed to purchasing one from a store or breeder.
Cute and sad and cute.
I know.
On Empire podcast number 237, Adam Driver revealed that he underwent training and became a licensed bus driver. He wanted to be able to be on autopilot while driving the bus. It also meant that the film could feature more authentic footage, opening up the possibilities for a greater variety of camera shots, of which there are so many. Mm-hmm. He was taught over a period of 3 months in Queens, New York City, passing the test 1 week before filming began.
My favorite thing about that was apparently the production team decided that he was going to do this, and they were, like, in, like, en route. I don't know words. They were in the process of scheduling this to happen, and during that process, they discovered that he was already doing this of his own volition, which I thought was super cute.
He's that actor.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. The budget for Patterson was approximately $5 million, and it, as of right now, it has earned back $10.8 million. So, not a bad return for a little film. Reception, critically, very well. Rotten Tomatoes aggregate score of 96%, and sitting at a 90 on Metacritic. Audience score, a little bit lower. Rotten Tomatoes audience aggregate of 72. IMDb audience score of a 7.4.
Hmm. Some interesting factoids. I don't think I will ever say that any other way.
I don't think so. From imdb.com and wikipedia.org.
I was getting there, Jesus. The film was shot over 30 days in the fall of 2015 in Paterson, New Jersey, and various locations in New York.
The film would go on to be nominated for 22 awards during the 2016-17 award season, including 8 Best Actor nominations for Adam Driver, 2 of which he won. The film was also nominated for Best Screenplay and Best Picture thrice apiece.
On Patterson's bedstand, there is a picture of a younger Patterson during his military service. This is an actual picture of Adam Driver from his time in the Marines, which I knew and guessed, I think, the first time we watched this.
Yes. There was no reference to twins in the original script. In a Q&A at the Landmark Sunshine Cinema in New York, Jim Jarmusch revealed the serendipity of the twins in the film. At the beginning of filming, he realized one of the children extras on a bus scene was, in fact, a twin when her mother and sister came to pick her up. He told the mother to bring both sisters for filming the next day and started to include twins throughout the rest of the shoot. He then added Laura's dialogue about her dream with twins. To him, the twins, as well as the dog-jacking foreshadowing, in the film are anti-significant. One might think at the end of the film Laura would be revealed to be pregnant with twins or that Marvin would be stolen, but neither occur.
Mm-hmm. Technical specs. Runtime is 1 hour 58 for 118 minutes total. Sound mix is Dolby Digital. Our aspect ratio is the 1.85:1, which is your regular widescreen. The cameras used were an Arri Alexa Mini, as per usual. That's the cinematography camera I would get if I could, as well as the Arri Alexa Studio, and Zeiss variable prime lenses were used. Negative format is SXS Pro. That has to be some sort of digital resolution. Digital format.
Mm-hmm.
Cinematographic process.
You're a master at that.
That took fucking long enough. I'm going to mess it up next week.
You're welcome.
ProRes 4444. It's 2K. Digital intermediate was the master format. So they filmed at 2K and then they exported it at 2K. That is a rare thing. Mm. And then the printed film format is D Cinema, which just means it's a digital projection.
Ba-da-da. Pew, pew, pew. So... digital is more cost-effective.
Yeah, I would assume.
I read an article about the cinematography of this film, and that's kind of what I... they used the cameras they used because they needed to squish into small spaces, and they used digital instead of film because of the tiny, tiny budget.
Well, yeah, the Arri Alexa Mini is... it's called a mini for a reason. Mm-hmm. It's a tiny camera.
Yeah.
And it's a good camera.
Hmm.
Pretty sure that's what they use for... they've used that for a lot of things, but Ghost Story came to mind.
Oh, cool.
I'm pretty
okay.
sure that's what they use for that.
Yeah.
Let's get to it.
Let's get to it. Tell me about direction.
Direction. I'd like to meet this director. This movie seems so different from his other two films that I am familiar with, but they all have this level of snark and subtleness that I think if you were to watch... Only Lovers Left Alive and The Dead Don't Die, along with this movie, kind of back to back or within kind of a reasonable time frame, I think you'd be able to make some obvious connections, which is really interesting. I'd be interested in doing that, actually. Patterson, out of the three, is somehow the most different, I think. It almost feels like he started with a mood or a feeling and then made a concept from there, and then from that concept a movie, if that makes any sense.
He said something along the lines, this is not verbatim, it's just something that stuck in my brain when I was doing research, something along the lines of he wants audiences to experience this film as though they would experience it like looking through a bus window and just passing it by. So I thought that that was a nice visual.
I nailed that then.
So yeah, I absolutely kind of had the same observation in that there's this part of me that's legit kind of blown away by the fact that Jim Jarmusch also directed Dead Don't Die and Only Lovers Left Alive. I enjoyed both of them, but they're both so kind of fantastical and outside of the realm of possibility. And looking at those and then looking at this, which is such an intimate, kind of insidious slice of life film, they seem completely out of the realm of what I'm used to seeing from him. I saw the other two, and then a couple years later, I saw Patterson. This is my favorite of his films that I've seen, and I think it's because I admire what he was able to do with the premise of just following the life of a bus driver who also happens to be a poet for a week. That's the film. And yet he crafted something that sticks with me for days, if not weeks, whenever I watch it. And it's just, he's just this master storyteller and creator. All of the reviews of this rant and rave about how just there's this beauty in the mundane in this film, and he manages to capture it. And I think that takes a really masterful writer and a really masterful filmmaker.
I'd agree. It's interesting because he's like done some shorts, and I think he's done some music videos. And it's kind of interesting that he hasn't done more. I mean, I know we both know how the creative process goes, so I don't...
There are some projects that he worked for years. That interview that I was watching out in the living room, like, I forget exactly which one it was, but there was one, maybe not documentary, but maybe documentary style project that he worked on for a ridiculous number of years.
I'm just glancing at his Rotten Tomatoes. And most of them, whatever they are, are pretty well received.
Yeah.
There's a couple here and there that really aren't. The Dead Don't Die kind of being one of them.
Oh, what did that get?
I got a 55-38.
That's right. That's right.
Which is, I mean, that's a quirky movie.
It is.
That is almost like a poster for quirky movies.
Are you ready? Are you ready? Are you ready? Jules. Ghouls.
Ghouls. Yeah. That's an Adam Driver line. Anyway.
I watched the trailer for that movie.
I sent it to you. I think I was the one that showed you it.
You did. You definitely were. And I watched it so many times when I needed a pick-me-up because Adam Driver is just so fucking adorable.
Yeah, whoever cut the trailer for that did a great job.
A++++++++.
Yeah. writing and the characterization. The reoccurring twins are funny and obviously just something that gets stuck in Patterson's head. It's even more funny to know that that wasn't intentional and it was brought in later. The reoccurring themes or ideas that constantly sort of like pop up throughout are an interesting look at how creative individuals look at things and how it affects them. And I think that is like a huge takeaway from this movie. My favorite poem is by the little girl who was waiting for her mom. And I don't know what that says about me. The Run is my second favorite poem, which is actually by Patterson, or the actual poet who wrote it.
Was it Ron Padgett? Oh, I was right. Ron Padgett.
Yep. It's just making me think of Brewster Padgett.
I wish I would have written down which ones were which, but apparently he wrote a total of, I think, 7 poems. And I'm going to mess it up. I think 4 of them had already been written and 3 were original, or vice versa. 3 were already written and 4 he wrote originally for the film.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
In conjunction with the editing and the cinematography, you really, really get a feel. You get the feeling of how much doesn't kind of change in his day-to-day until He takes Everett down, and that he's kind of shaken up, which is real interesting that that's a little bit of a catalyst. Not so much a catalyst, but it definitely, it quite literally shakes him up, and I think that's the start of kind of when his routine gets mixed up, and, you know, he starts, he leaves his book on the couch, and I think some other things happen, and it was, I don't know if that's the actual trigger moment, your face right now.
I disagree with you.
Oh, interesting. I just said I wasn't sure, mm-hmm. but while the poems are not my favorite thing about this movie, because I'm just not a super, super poem person, which is kind of like the heart of this movie, sorry, I do enjoy that we get this first draft sort of thing and then a second draft, and you can feel the difference between the two versions, and kind of you get to feel like how he feels about, excuse me, the poems, because he often recites them differently, and it's mm-hmm. I don't know that's an interesting, I really enjoy that aspect of this movie.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that I actually say it later, so I'll tell you now. I think the first thing that happens that throws everything off and kind of spins into like the climax is the bus breaks down.
Oh, does that happen first? Mm-hmm. No, okay, you're probably right.
I think so. I think that happens on Friday afternoon.
You're probably Friday is the day.
Friday's the day, yeah.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
Fiery explosion.
I like how the theme of the film mimics the way that Patterson creates his poetry, and it's almost spelled out for us right at the very beginning. There's beauty in poetry and mundanity. Ohio blue tip matches, for example, a simple item that he sees in his home that he finds inspiration from crescendos into a love poem about the woman that he loves. We're watching a movie about a man who lives a straightforward life and finds comfort and joy in that life, and the writing suggests that he's able to do so because he finds beauty and grace in the mundane. And that very theme and idea makes my heart ache and, like, immediately draws me into this movie. Like, that first poem, like, he starts out, like, Ohio blue tip. And he starts again with the Ohio blue tip. And I'm like, motherfucker, what is it about these fucking matches? Like, why do you have such a hard-on for these matches? And then the poem grows, and you see where it leads him. And it's like all of this from a box of matches. And it makes me just think of the movie, where on the surface, it's a movie about a guy doing stuff. And then it crescendos into this underlying theme where you just get the heart and the soul of this person. And
This is very, 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 very much a Leisha movie.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. This is a lot of people's movie, apparently. People love the shit out of this movie. There's a strange underlying tension in this film that really hooked me the first time I watched. And unfortunately, this particular tension only works on the first watch, but it's so, so nice. There are setups for conflicts that don't come to fruition, such as Marvin getting stolen from the bar, or I wrote Marvin and didn't mean Marvin, or Patterson and Laura getting into some kind of dispute. These things don't happen, and we're lulled into this sense of security. This makes it so that in the end, you know, when Everett pulls the gun, when Patterson's notebook gets chewed up, things like that, the bus breaks down, it feels more impactful because I was keyed up the entire time. The whole time I was watching, I'm on edge waiting for some explosion to happen, waiting for something to happen that doesn't. And then when these things happen, I was just like, oh, shit, things are happening, even if they seem small.
I did not feel that way about the bus at all.
Mm.
The bus didn't affect me in any way.
It was such a... He's so used to driving this bus day in and day out. Nothing happens. Then he breaks down. He doesn't know what to do. There's no payphone. And he has to rely on the phone of a child.
Laughing at that, though. Like, I'm just like, you... It's like the setup is, why don't you have a phone? Mm-hmm. And you know something's gonna happen when he needs a phone, and I'm just like, see?
But I like his point, though, which was the world survived without them, and I completely think that's legitimate.
The world survived
that
without
always hits me
at a time, and then the world evolved. So, like,
but buses used to break down, and cars used to break down, and all that shit used to happen,
and so we developed technology to help us with that.
Well, we still got by without it. And he very well could have walked to a store right from where he was. Like, I don't know. I think that kind of this tension that I experienced the first time really builds a wonderfully realistic parallel to life and how things that aren't necessarily devastating can feel like they are when we're so used to the patterns of our days in and our days out.
Mm-hmm.
The repetitiveness of some aspects of the days is a really great writing tool as well. Every morning we see Patterson wake in his bed between 6 and 7:30, alarm clock not necessary, and most days run pretty much the same. However, there are slight and subtle differences. He wakes up at a slightly different time every day. He and Laura are in different positions. His interactions with his boss are different. He always has them, but they're different. He overhears conversations on the bus, but they're always different. He walks Marvin and goes to the bar every night, but his observations and interactions are different. I think it's a really fantastic way to show how we can either focus on how everything remains static if we look at things from far away, or we can relish in the idiosyncrasies and the newness of every day if we pay attention and really kind of like allow ourselves to be present at every moment. And of course, when shit really goes haywire in the last 3 days with the bus breaking down and Everett and the notebook, these things are so goddamn jarring because they don't fit into that repetitive mold.
Mm-hmm.
I love the whole setup, and I think it speaks very much the themes do to how human behavior can work. And that's really, it fascinates the shit out of me.
Patterson. Writing notes for everybody was hard.
Oh.
I'm sure you, yep, you do. Mm. I'll make this quick. Patterson. He's quiet, an extremely good person, and mostly non-confrontational. I think it's that last trait that leads him to getting pushed around a bit. And I personally find it hard to tell how much he actually cares. And it might just stem from, you know, his former military life. It's so interesting. And I think you just basically touched on that. You know, his notebook gets torn up and he, like, doesn't react. And I think we expect someone to kind of, like, explode in that moment. Like, I certainly would have. And I think we're kind of tense for that. Like, we're waiting for him to do something and he just kind of walks away. I don't know. It was an interesting kind of reaction from this. What is your face?
Just you saying that he doesn't react. Maybe he doesn't react in an explosive manner like you expect, but I'm thinking, you're saying we don't see him react, and I'm just like, how are you saying that? Like, how? After all of these engagements and the care and attention that he makes sure to engage with his wife and always pays attention to her, listens to her, completely shuts down. He walks away from her. He walks away from her the next day.
Okay, therapist
lady. He declines to listen to her song. He doesn't engage with her physically when she engages with him. He doesn't care enough that he lets the fucking dog in. And all he hates that fucking dog, and he doesn't give a shit. He just lets the dog in. He's just like, there's a numbness. And when he's sitting on that bench at the falls, the devastation on his face, you're saying he doesn't react, and I'm just like...
Okay, it's not a reaction I guess I was expecting. How about that?
Well, his character doesn't really build to someone who would be explosive.
For me, I was expecting a louder reaction. Like, to me, it was building up to that.
That's interesting.
Nobody can see my shrug.
No.
I do it all the time.
It's like you're on the phone. I have to remind myself of that. Yeah. No, god damn.
I told you it was really hard to write about everybody.
There are so many things that I love about Patterson as a character. More than anything, I adore that he's written as an unassuming, quiet, perhaps even uninteresting character on the surface, if one is willing to look past his movements. In reality, we get an extremely focused glimpse into this multi-layered man. A former soldier whose instinct is to protect and act in crisis are still well-honed. A man who relishes patterns and routines because they're safe and yet shows the ability to adapt. A man who cares too much to hide the fact that he hates his wife's new dinner. Thank you for pointing that out to me.
Mm-hmm.
And wants to help the heartbroken man at the bar. Patterson is a man who respects everyone he comes across, particularly children, it seems, and he respects art. He also hates his wife's dog, has a fear of being leashed, and shows an astounding level of emotional repression that he gets out via poetry instead of speaking to others. He's not perfect, and he has a past we don't know a lot about, and it seems to be just sitting there, kind of simmering below the surface. He can be ridiculously sarcastic and laughs at inappropriate times, and I just, honest to God, feel this character in my bones. He's such a well-developed character that it's hard for me to believe that he's not just, like, out there driving around. He doesn't, to me, seem like someone who's unfeeling or non-reactive. It seems like it's right there, but the only way that he knows how to get it out is through writing. Which, why he learned that, who the fuck knows? Or how he learned that? Or sometimes that's just what some of us do. So, he's such a fascinating character to me.
Laura, as a person, I don't think I could stand being around her for very long. But she's an interesting look at a sort of compulsive creative type that just goes, and is a sort of jack of all trades and has yet to find that one thing that she can really, like, grab and run with. And I kind of, I think, relate to that a little bit. But she's so obnoxious.
Aw.
The actress did great. I'll talk more on that later, but, like, oh, I can't stand this character.
She's really fascinating. I can never quite determine if she is exactly the ass opposite of Patterson.
Right.
Or if she simply exerts the same energy differently. She seems whimsical, dreamy, and kind of indescribably aspirational, which feels exactly the opposite, and he seems to be balanced by that energy and kind of plays into it. However, she owns her own fastidiousness. She likes patterns, solid blacks, whites, very little in between. She's a stop-or-go person, all or nothing. Patterson must try to publish his poems, according to her. She must get this guitar right now. Marvin must be put in the garage after eating the notebook, even when Patterson lets him back into the house. She's her own creature of habit, at times seemingly more rigid than Patterson. When they go to the movie, she states, "I do like that it was in black and white, for Christ's sake." They're a good match. She's constantly supportive and pushes him to believe in himself while chasing her own dreams and accepting support as well, making her more than just, like, the lamp. Mm-hmm. The woman, the supporting female character, making her more than just a piece of furniture in a movie, which I also really liked.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking, you were talking about that kind of fantastical feeling that it occasionally has and how they kind of live in this bubble inside their house. And I was like, but wait, they go to the movies and that bubble is broken and they are around other people. That was just a weird...
You just don't see them interact together with other... I mean, you know that they do. Yeah. It's just it creates this feeling of it's the two of them existing in a bubble because you don't see the two of them. Yeah.
I was just thinking about that. Marvin.
Marvin.
This dog has snark. Marvin might be my favorite. I love this unspoken war happening between him and Patterson, yes. And no one knows why. What's the point? I would never tell you to get rid of any of your pets unless they were destroying shit, which ours occasionally do. But, like, I don't know. This is like the best part of this movie for me.
The war seems to simply just be that Marvin is, like, so possessive of Laura.
Like, it was like our one dog.
Dis mine.
Our one dog that we used to have with you.
Yes, exactly. Oh, God, yeah, Marvin. On the one hand, the dog's an asshole. On the other hand, I'm pretty sure he thinks he's playing a game with Patterson half the time. This dog is, like, preternaturally smart and also hilarious and also the literal villain in this movie, which I think is funny as fuck. Because that's so true. Arch nemeses. We have pets that are assholes in real life.
Like, I didn't even think of that as him as the villain. You're totally right. He's totally the antagonist. Duh.
I love it so much.
Dirk. Might be my second favorite character after the dog. I don't know. There's this weird kind of chillness about him, and more or less everything is going to be okay sort of vibe that I think most people in this movie need a dose of. Mm-hmm. And he's, like, there to provide it, like, at the end of the day and just kind of settle everything, like, physically and metaphorically. literally and kind of figuratively.
I like that. Yeah, and I also, too, I like that there's a duality to the bartender character. Because so often characters such as this are barely developed. But with Doc, we get a such nice, if minimal, bits of character and dialogue. Just some of the, little things, too. Like, he's kicking his own ass at chess, flirting with younger women, even though we know he's married, has so many first-name basis relationships with his patrons, and obviously has deep ties to Patterson. And these are all things that give him a depth other than, here's the guy that serves beer at the bar. It was a requirement to give him depth because he's a staple in Patterson's life. Someone who laughs with him, proves to be a soundboard, which he doesn't always get from his ever supportive wife, somebody who will kind of speak back to him, or back against him, so to speak. Doc is kind of like a homing beacon, just like Laura, and kind of like just like the falls for Patterson.
I see your chunk of text for Everett.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be interested to see what you say, because what I have to say isn't great.
Oh,
he's so obnoxious. Go away. I can't fucking stand him. It's nice to see that this character actually acknowledges that his actions were kind of absurd and practically harmful, and more or less moves on after apologizing to Patterson. And I assume that he apologizes to Doc and Marie.
I mean, to go beyond, yes, he's obviously a little prick and ridiculous.
I just want to punch him in the face.
Sure. He's such an interesting mirrorverse version of Patterson to me. He's controlling, over-emotional, over-dramatic, unpredictable, visibly passionate, and speaks about his love as though he owns her and she owes him her time and attention. It's fascinating to see both Everett and Patterson as men who love the women in their lives and yet love as complete opposites. I think it's a really nice juxtaposition in the end of the film to use Everett as an example of a broken man who's now put together as he walks away from Patterson, a man we've seen as put together who is in the moment broken. The creation and use of this character is incredibly brilliant.
He can still fuck off.
Now it works.
Bye.
There's purpose.
Bye.
Miss American Pie.
Get the fuck out.
I live here. Continue. Production design.
I find the house very constricting, which I'm not quite sure if that's purposeful or not. I believe that it is, and I think it's well done. And I think part of that has to do with how big Adam Driver is. So they found like the tiniest house they could and put this large ass man inside. I also really love Patterson's little writing nook. I would kill to have a little space I could close myself off into. I love all of Laura's projects and how there's this like unifying black and white theme. And that's just the thought that had to go into all of that is insane, because it's all super varied. It's not just a black and white theme. It's, you know, we have a black and white theme with zigzags. We have a black and white checker theme. We have a black and white circular theme. We have a black and white striped theme. Polka dots, mix and match. Mm-hmm. It's just ridiculous. I want the notebook that Patterson gets at the end. Mm-hmm. It's so pretty.
It is very pretty.
So pretty.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get around it after watching Patterson and Laura's house is fascinating. I keep using that word, and it's just, as I hear myself echoing myself, it's just, that's what I think about this movie. This movie fascinates the shit out of me. I love how detailed the props department, props to props, and set designers get with Laura's black and white style. And I like watching the decor expand throughout the film. Yeah. It's like every time he comes home, he doesn't necessarily make mention. You just watch, and it's just like the black and white is like spreading.
One of the funniest moments in this movie is where he's sitting on the couch.
Yes.
And he rests his arm on some like blankets and shit that are next to him, and then like immediately like whips his arm away because he thinks, ow, that there might be some paint on his shirt.
Yes.
And he's just like, oh no, is there wet paint on this? Did you just paint this? And he's like checking his sleeve and checking like to see if it's wet or dry on the blanket or whatever it is.
Yes.
That was one of the best moments.
I love it so much though, because that's a prime example. He doesn't say anything. and he doesn't act inconvenienced, and it's just like, oh, I wonder if this is one of her things. Like, shit, I need to check my clothes. I think this is a great example. This movie was nominated for 3 different awards by, I don't remember the name of it because I'm a terrible, terrible researcher. But it was basically nominated for, from like a women's film panel or organization for like this character and this depiction of this couple, because it's very much like a non-sexist, a non-tropey relationship, a non exactly
relationship.
Even though he works outside the home and she doesn't, it's not portrayed in the way that you expect. And I think that what you've just said is a great example. It's not like, oh shit, it's one of my wife's little projects and I'm gonna be mad about it. It's, oh, I wonder if there's bleach on this because this is something that she does and I need to check and see. Mm-hmm. And he's just like, whatever.
It's like, oh, okay.
And she's painting the fucking door frames black. And she's like, I think it makes everything more interesting, doesn't it? And he's just like, oh, yeah. And just like, she has freedom within the home and to do. And he just like goes with it. And I love it. I love it. But yeah, just the expansion of the black and white decor. Every time he comes home, every time I watch this movie, I'm just like, how much more is there? What did I miss? There are small things everywhere you look, and I catch more and more. On the last watch, I noticed, like, the mug beside his cereal bowl when he's eating is black and white. And it's just in every single scene in their house. I love it so much. I really like the bar that they chose to film in, which I think was in the Bronx, if I'm not mistaken. I totally could be mistaken, but I know it was in New York. The bar felt as familiar and even more comfortable than Patterson's home, and I think told the audience a story, too, about the town of Patterson. Its population, its people, its history with the literal stories that you get about the newspaper clippings, who's from Patterson, you know, things like that. This movie felt like a love poem to the city of Patterson, just as much as it was about this man, which I also really like. And there are so many nice little details throughout the film that capture my attention every time that I watch. The items inside of Patterson's lunchbox, the designs of Laura's cupcakes, Adam Driver's old military photo, the small details inside of Patterson's cramped writing room in the basement. All of these things help to build the universe and these characters into individuals who feel very real and very well-rounded. The attention to detail in this movie is fucking out of this world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cinematography.
So, cinematography. I need to open my cinematography notes by saying that I love the visuals in this film so much from start to finish. Nothing is particularly fancy. And in the cinematography interview, I read an interview with a cinematographer, and it was basically just like, how did you try to mix shit up in a film where everything is so straightforward? And it was little things. It was like changing the camera. I forget what it's called, like the ratio or something, or widening the lens or the view, like every morning when they're looking down at them in the bed. Like,
oh, just get farther away.
They get further away, yeah. And they change something about the camera, something like that.
Angle, lens.
Yeah, and so, like, and it's legit, just, like, nothing is fancy. But everything's captured in such a way to incorporate life and movement into moments that are ordinarily stagnant, such as focusing on the swinging feet of children too short to reach the floor of the bus instead of showing them simply sitting and talking. These small shots add so much character, and they're everywhere. The character or the camera doesn't always focus on where you expect it to be. And I like that a lot. During the scene on the bus, when we see the two men talking about their supposed near conquests with women over the weekend, I love that scene. We see their knees touching. They're very close. And at the very least, the man on the left side of the screen appears to be romantically interested in the other, if not a mutual interest in each other.
Yeah, we both caught on to that.
Yes. And if it's not intentional, I gotta say, y'all had some mad chemistry. All that to say that there's a standing pole of the bus splitting the screen between them, and it causes for such a stark visual separation, just of the two characters, and it acts as such a great storytelling device, even on a subconscious level, and I really appreciate that. Like, they're so close, but there's still separation there, and I just, hurts my soul.
I feel like that happens on a number of occasions.
Absolutely. I absolutely love the shot that we get of Laura's hand coming to rest on Patterson's shoulder when he's writing in his little basement nook, We see her hand and arm approaching in the mirror before her face is revealed in the foreground of the shot. It's so lovely. It's such a neat shot. And the final scene where Patterson and the poet from Japan are sharing the park bench broke me this last time that I watched it. There's a water pipe in the background, and the way they're positioned, it looks like a forward slash between the two characters. There's literally, like, a damn visual relationship built between the two of them. Two poets from different parts of the world coming together at an imperative moment in time to propel Patterson forward, for a moment only separated by a single slash. It's such a literary heavy visual as far as symbolism goes, and I verbalized that. I saw it and I got chills up and down my whole body, and it just, I felt crushed by it.
We also have that pipe in between them, but then like each side of the pipe is different. Like you've got the concrete staircase, and then you've got rocks and
flora. It's part of like the quarry area. Yep, absolutely. I love that shot so much.
Yeah, no, it's that whole last scene is really nice on a variety of levels. Mm-hmm. For me personally, as no surprise, the cinematography is the highlight of this movie. All of the reflections in this movie are insane. The amount of setup that would have to go into some of these must have taken so much thought and manpower. And we're talking about, you know, they're on a bus, they're shooting on a bus, they're purposely shooting at the windshield and using like a specific, they probably are using like a specific filter, like a polarizer or something on the lens. And what that does is it allows you to either adjust it so you see the reflection on the windshield, or you can adjust it to see through the windshield. So like, you know, that is a lot of, there's a lot of like, I think, lens theory that went into this movie to get some of the shots, and not just even, it's, you know, the DP was said that it was only little things to kind of vary it up. But to me, just watching this movie, and I obviously have no idea how they actually filmed it, I feel like that's being a little modest. But who knows? He's just really good at what he does.
Yeah, dude.
I love and hate the overlapping shots of driving and the watch showing the passage of time. What?
I have a note about that later.
Okay. I love the idea of it. And I don't know if it's just visually, like, overstimulating to me and just too muddled most of the time, because this is a pretty muted film, just kind of color-wise. There isn't a lot of brightness. It's all kind of a very, like, landscape-y city, if that makes any sense, like, tone, color tone.
There's a lot of red brick.
A lot of, like, grays, a lot of muted reds and muted blues. So when you overlap a lot of that, it's all like the same color, and you don't quite, and I guess this doesn't matter, this is purely personal preference of not being able to distinguish it as much as I personally would like to, or like that my brain needs. But like seeing the watch move like it does, and it's just a very interesting way to like show the passage of time, because you don't get that a lot. You get like the showing of the watch, or you get like a montage of like the day going by, but you don't kind of get them overlapped in such a way. There's a lot of scenery shots with or without Patterson that are just so aesthetically pleasing. I almost want to freeze frame, print it out, and frame it on our walls. The shot of the lamp in the curtain from Patterson's POV as he's looking up, as he's laying in bed, is probably one of my favorite shots in the entire film.
I almost said something, but when it came on, I saw you start typing, and I was like, okay, she's got this.
The super close-up of Laura picking up the scraps of paper from Patterson's shredded notebook is so lovely. Mm-hmm. So lovely. Editing.
I'm just in moments. Ugh, okay. I really like the handwriting on the screen along with the voiceover work. And the fact that they added them in tandem in post rather than one or the other. Handwriting and one's voice are both very intimate details, and getting all of the kind of sensory detail that we get from Patterson, I think, adds a duality that's necessary to kind of capture the depth of his character and his emotion when writing and experiencing the poetry. So yeah. I like that both of those were factored in.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely love the overlapping images when Patterson is writing by the falls. The rushing water and the white caps against the stillness of Patterson while writing creates a feeling of action, even though we're simply watching a character think and put pen to paper. And it makes me feel as though I'm part of an action sequence, watching something come into creation in a way that's not dull. And I really like that. I am super interested to hear your thoughts about the fade-in and fade-outs between the end and beginning of each new day. Personally, I like them. I think a soft and slow fade to black feels like going to sleep, and fading in much the same way feels like waking up.
I actually didn't make any notes about them, but I actually agree with what you just said. I think that's an appropriate way to do that, and what you just said is nails it.
Nice. Okay. I was wondering. Holy God. The fact that the last poem in the film is called The Line, and the stanzas appear on screen below a hard line of some sort, whether it's the top rail of a fence or below the bottom of a windowsill, nearly makes me want to fucking punch something and cry. So nice. Jesus Christ. So you mentioned this a little bit earlier, and it was that I had read in a random movie review something along the lines of this film almost feeling like there's a fantasy element to it, something fantastical. In a way, I agree, because this character seems to exist in a vacuum of his own reality of sorts, and in a space where time seems to be manipulated in its repetitiveness. We even see the effect of his watch speeding through the day multiple times.
He's a wizard.
Okay. But I think that gives us the experience that he has, where he goes to work and time just passes. He, like Adam Driver said, he wanted to learn how to drive the bus so he could do it without thought. And we see Patterson driving the bus almost without thought, and he's just listening.
Mm-hmm.
He's paying attention to what's happening around him and doing his job almost mindlessly. And that passage of time, and it shows on the watch, I thought seemed very realistic, where he's just, the day's just slipping by. Mm-hmm. I liked that. I think the way that this film is edited reflects this very well, in that through cuts and different techniques, we're not simply watching a straightforward, like, 3-second scene cut, 3-second scene cut, rinse and repeat film. By the time this film ends, I both feel like I've lived with Patterson for an entire week, as though I've just started watching and no time has passed at all. It's a bizarre pacing that works, but I can't quite figure out how to pinpoint how it works. Like, I feel like I've just started this movie, and now I suddenly have all of this intimate character knowledge of this person, and that leaves me a little fucked in the head, honestly. And I also feel like I've been watching this movie for an entire span of a week, and I have this intimate knowledge because I spent so much time with this character. And it just, that part fucks with me, too, is I feel like time, it's, I don't know. There's a lot about this movie that fucks with me. That's the end of my editing notes.
You and I experience this movie very differently. I agree that this movie feels like it takes a week to watch.
Fuck you.
First up, first time watching this, I checked my watch, thinking the movie had to be almost over, only to discover,
God,
I had an hour left.
Fuck you.
It was only half over. The second watch at 1.5 speed felt faster for obvious reasons. And not nearly as dragged out. It didn't feel like a week. It felt like an appropriate amount of time sped up. I wasn't quite sure where to put this next note, but there's something about this movie that is extremely calming.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that all of the times that I've watched...
God damn it. I just stop. Don't say it.
This movie, I get so very sleepy. There it is. Our first watch for this episode. It's just before the final third of the movie that I am struggling to stay awake.
You were struggling with some hard. You were like wrapped up in your hoodie on the couch, like slowly slipping down.
I'm pretty sure like I did like the head nod and I was like, and yeah, I was struggling hard.
I wasn't going to say anything, but like every time I looked over, your body was slumped slightly more.
I have mixed feelings. I think it just depends on which image images are being used, about the overlapping segments that we get with two or three different bits of footage being used at the same time. So like the kind of weird overlapping montages that we get, whether he's talking about a poem or he's on the bus. There's a specific one that I really, really like though. And it's, I don't remember the poem. I forgot to write that down, but it's, you might have mentioned it. I can't remember. The poem over the just like the close-up of the water falling, mixed with footage of like Laura kind of turning around. I think she's...
Was it Pumpkin?
I honestly do not remember.
No, Pumpkin was written in the basement, I think. Was it the one where it was, he's talking about, if you ever leave me, I would rip my heart out?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I think it's before that one.
Right. Yeah.
But it was just, I don't know. It just kind of like the flow of images worked really well. Mm-hmm. And I just with the word, his words, his voice, and just because you can kind of, with the sound design, you kind of get the sound of the waterfalls behind it. And I don't know. I just really liked. There's a couple moments of those that I just want that in a movie. I just want that up on the background as I'm doing something, and I can just like occasionally look up from whatever I'm doing and have like a moment of zen. That is what I would prefer. But yeah, music. I like a lot of the natural sounds that we get when there isn't any music. Like I don't know if it's just me kind of missing Detroit a little bit, but like having those city sounds is really, whoever the sound mixer on set was, did a lovely job. But when we do have music, it's this, you know, sort of subtle and quiet and very fitting with the overall tone of the music. I could probably listen to the soundtrack of this movie as I fall asleep. Like it's, that plays into my nodding off during this movie.
I don't really notice the soundtrack of this film when I'm watching because I feel like there's so much to look at and other things to listen to at all times. The music provides an almost ambient background noise. Yeah. At least that's what I thought until we watched it on 1.5 speed. And then I noticed the music is incredibly present. At some points, really fucking forceful. Like, the music sped up a little bit was really anxiety-provoking for me.
Well, yeah, especially at 1.5 speed. Yeah. We were talking about how
His cadence
when he's speaking sped up was kind of anxiety-inducing and very urgent sounding.
Well, of course, because we had watched it. It's supposed to be very soothing and very...
Well, just the difference. I mean, 1.5 speed isn't that much faster. Yeah. So, like, the difference between the two is extremely and surprisingly jarring.
It is very jarring, and I feel like that says a lot to the intentionality of how this film was made and the speed and the cadence and just the timing of everything. But like, yeah, listening to the music and noticing it when it was sped up and actually having like heard it and paid attention, at some points it's really forceful, and it makes me believe that just like most everything in this damn movie, it works on a subconscious level. Performances.
Adam Driver.
Adam Driver.
It's Adam fucking Driver. What else is there to say?
I was just thinking of, like, wasn't that your note for Samuel L. Jackson?
Probably.
Yeah.
Which says a lot.
I start with a question. And that's, how the fuck does someone smile without even moving their damn face? I want to know how Adam Driver portrays every emotion known to man in this film with the most subtle performance I've possibly ever seen. It pains me to watch this and know that this character doesn't exist for a multitude of reasons, mainly because Adam did such a spectacular job of bringing a whole-ass human being to life. he's not Adam Driver at any point in this film. He's not Kylo Ren. He's not anyone you've ever seen before.
Does that in every
he does. And does. But this one I feel is just, it's so mind blowing because this character feels so real.
It's very natural.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, what comes to mind, I'll talk about it later, actually.
This is one of those movies where when the film ends, I get this really deep, and I think this is what sticks with me. I connect with this character a lot.
I could tell you that.
You did tell me that.
I did tell you that. After we watched.
I connect with him so much that this film ends, and, you know, Jim Jarmusch and Adam Driver did such a good job bringing this character to life that I have this profound feeling of loss that just, like, this isn't real. Like, this is one of those films that, like, it makes me hurt that, like, this isn't an actual thing. Like, this is make-believe, and I don't want it to be. So that's kind of this experience that he gives me in this role.
Interesting. I am so sorry. Can you say her name? Yeah, I apologize to her directly.
I'll probably not get it perfect, but Golshifteh Farahani.
Yeah. She does amazingly. This is kind of one of those instances where I really want to see her other work, but I know I'm going to be in a little bit of shock seeing her act any other way than how she performs being Laura. Like, similarly to Adam, she feels like she's this character. She's Laura. And which is crappy because I can't stand the character. I'm sure she's a wonderful
person.
She's so
totally different. I was watching some of her interviews, and she's just, she's so totally different.
I'm sure she is. I'm not saying, and that's how good her performance is. Just, like, you believe that she's this character.
Mm-hmm. She's so damn cute and easy to love. She has this big-eyed, mystical ability to draw you in when she's on screen, and she's so genuine that it hurts. She was this wonderful... she was wonderful when on screen with Adam because she didn't appear to let his performance impact her. And in that, she really made this couple feel like a couple, like two entirely separate individuals sharing a space and a life together. She brought an independence to this role rather than acting as though Laura was simply a supporting character. And she just did a really beautiful job at that. And that was incredibly necessary.
Oh, yeah. Barry Chewbacca Henley. He did great. He put me at ease after dealing with the chaos that is most everyone else aside from Adam's character. Like I said earlier, he's my favorite human character in this movie. He plays my favorite human character in this movie, and it's just, he does chill in a really interesting way that I think other creatives could kind of look at and take notes from.
Nice. I'm sorry, but this dude is such a dad. He's legitimately a father who just walked on set and was told to parent a bunch of young adults whose lives were falling apart. Convince me otherwise. He was sweet and funny and just really fun to watch and enjoyable and seemed, like I said, even as an actor almost, seemed to be like a homing device for the others on set, like on screen. And it was just, you know, he felt imperative to be there.
Mm. William Jackson Harper. I can see sort of where we get cheaty, but at the same time, this is nowhere near that character.
This is great.
What?
Keep talking.
Rude.
I love you.
You're rude. You can tell that he takes whatever you can tell that he takes whatever character is given to him and runs with it, giving more than needed and always enjoyable.
I absolutely adore William Jackson Harper. It's hard for me to look at him without seeing Chidi from The Good Place, because that's where I met him, but it's really hard for me to find Chidi here. And that's a great thing. He plays an... Quack. Don't quack at me. He plays an overdramatic actor incredibly well. And I think that his individual scenes with Driver are fantastic, particularly his nonverbal acting. He's a gem.
I will say that you watched every episode of that show, of The Good Place. I did not. Mm-hmm. So I am going off of what I've seen, which is not a lot, to be honest. So.
Oh, you miss out. You miss out so bad. This is a plug for The Good Place, by the way. The whole reason we're doing this episode.
Not Adam Driver.
Not Adam Driver.
et ceteras. I don't understand why Patterson walks past the bar the first time. Is it just Marvin, like, pulling him past the bar? And I just not pay enough attention to that to see that? I don't know. Anyway. For fuck's sake,
no.
Just fix your dumb fucking mailbox. What irritates me the most about that is that it's obviously like a mechanism because movies, but he pulls it back upright and then goes to step on the post to push it. It doesn't move. Mm-hmm. It doesn't move at all. He's not pushing it down.
You look so angry.
In any way. I hate it.
You're scaring me a little bit.
Lies. You're a liar.
I'm lying.
I hate it. It doesn't move. You're not doing anything. And I know it's just a running gag and just further war games with Marvin, but fuck.
You know what I like about that, though? This movie goes over the span of a week, and you're yelling at him to fix the damn mailbox. How long have we needed to put wood putty on that fucking door out there? How long have we needed to do certain things that don't get done? That's another very realistic
thing about this movie. Okay, but he's doing something about it. That's not doing anything. The wood on the door, we haven't done anything. We haven't even attempted to get the fuck out.
You know what I'm saying, though.
Sort of, but like, I think what irritates me the most is that he adjusts it.
I know.
And he steps on it. I don't move. He's not...
Don't move.
He's not pushing
it. Do not move.
He's not pushing it any farther into the ground.
It ain't moving.
If anything, it pops up. Jesus. Fuck you.
He steps on it, just springboards into the air.
Yeah, like he like, yeah.
Yep. Oh, that mailbox, the pogo stick.
I just thought of pogo from Umbrella Academy.
I'm crying.
Okay.
Shit.
Oh my god.
The image in my mind, though.
Oh my god. The kids, aside from the kids on the bus, because they're children, some of the minor characters' acting ability is so cringy, and it really hurts my soul. I cannot listen to most of the conversations on the bus. Ugh. The acting is terrible. Awful. It's almost like he pulled people from the street and was like, this is what I want you to talk about generally. Go with it. And they were uncomfortable and they didn't really know what they were doing, or they were like actors that just got out of community college and didn't know what they were doing.
Damn.
I cannot stand the bus conversations. I do really enjoy Method Man showing up.
Yes.
That is a very genuine scene.
I love it.
And I love it a lot.
I love the connection of two artists so much.
Yes. Quit stealing my water. I didn't think
you haven't been drinking it.
I have been drinking it, you dick. I tried saying disc. I said dick.
Dude,
yesterday. I like stuttered on the word too.
You're like, oh, I think it. Oh, I was talking about how we were playing this at 1.5 speed and it actually had subtitles. Yeah. And you were like, is it a Blu-ray? I was like, yeah. And you were like, oh yeah, it depends on the dick. Like, subtitles depends on that D. And it just devolved from there. Oh god. That was a good call. I did not make note of that, but I had wanted to. I love that scene as well,
where the Method Man scene.
He's just listening and watching and commenting and talking, and he's.
I almost put it down as like my favorite part, but
yeah,
I didn't.
Yeah. Et cetera. Ready? Here's a quote, a dead ass quote from the movie. Hey. I mean, Alexander Hamilton has a statue. Others got statues, but not their own park. So, Doc slipped the reference in there for me without even having to try. Thank you, Doc.
This popped up on our first watch, and I just, like, casually turned my head in her direction and glared hard.
I don't know every line of dialogue. I was filled with glee. I was super stoked.
I know you were.
Because the first half dozen, however many times I've seen this movie, I didn't give a fuck about Alexander. I still don't.
I'm pretty sure I made a really, like, disgruntled noise.
You did. You were like, I still don't give a fuck about the actual Alexander Hamilton, but...
You like this made-up, make-believe version?
Oh, yeah. Give me the fictional Alex Hamilton any day. Yeah. But, yeah. Anyway, moving on. At first, I was pissed that nothing happened with the twins. I was scratching my head wondering what the hell the point was, but then realized there didn't need to be a point. So I was really happy to hear that it was just, like, a thing. It was non-significant or whatever it was that he said. It makes me think of those times when you really don't notice something until it's pointed out to you or someone mentioned it, yeah. mentions it, and then you hear about and see that thing everywhere.
The number 23.
God, when yeah. When I was a kid, after the day that I learned who Henry Rollins was, I heard his name and saw that fucker's face everywhere for months. It became a thing within my family. It was actually really hilarious. This seems to happen with Patterson and twins once Laura mentions them in the beginning of the film. Once again, the presence of them seems spectacular, but becomes something normalized. Like, this is a sensation that we all get, and I really love that.
The thought that ran through my head is, statistically, I don't think you would run into this many twins.
How often do we pay attention? Mm. Now we will. Well, it's pandemic times.
So we won't.
So we won't. The humor in this film is so, so understated and sneaks in so naturally that I often forget it's there. When I think of this movie, I don't think about laughing. And so when we were watching this last time and I found myself laughing out loud, it's just that nice reminder of, like, oh, right, Patterson is kind of a low-key, snarky dick, and this is why I love him.
Oh, at me.
A little bit at you. But just, you know, where he's laughing at Everett the first time at the bar, like, he and Doc are laughing and he has his head turned and he's just trying so hard. And Everett's just like, yeah, laugh at the heartbroken man or whatever. And he can't stop. Like, I love that. And, like, we were talking a little bit, you had pointed out, like, sometimes he just, like, tugs at Laura or pokes or prods at her a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it either flies under her radar or it doesn't, and she's fully aware of it, which I tend to believe. But
and she doesn't let it bother her. No, she doesn't. Like, shrugs it off.
And it's just like he's got a little bit of snark there at almost all times, and it's so subtle, and I love
that.
That seems
like the one characteristic of Adam Driver that might slip through. He seems like the type that would just be kind of like covertly snarky.
Perhaps. I remember watching the first time and believing so hard at the end that Patterson would just be like, no, it's all good. I actually went and got those copies of my secret notebook made this morning. Thanks for the suggestion, dear. Happy ending. Obviously, this doesn't happen. And at first, I felt so damn bereft. However, I wound up absolutely grateful for the loss of his notebook and that it was permanent, because it leads to the gem of the poet at the end being able to state, sometimes the empty page presents the most possibilities, which, as a writer and thinking through Patterson's perspective, is such an oh, right, or an aha moment. I love that. I'm not used to films, and I think, what was this, 2016? Oh, yeah, that was, like, the beginning of my Adam Driver love affair. In you're still getting used to movies kind of that, you know, mid 2010s, early 2010s idea that movies don't always have happy endings, and it becomes more and more prevalent to have realism in movies. So I think I was taken aback, but in a really nice way.
And as we've stated, you know, we're fans.
Oh, absolutely.
For some reason, of movies like that.
Most of the time, yeah. I just want to note that I love, love, love the fact that Adam Driver is the only major speaking role in this film who's not a person of color.
Yeah.
I love and adore this more than words can say, particularly because I never noticed until this last watch. This film doesn't fall into any kind of stereotyping, and neither does the character of Patterson.
Oh, they fight like real people.
And it's so... Zach and Mary make a porno. And it's so... good. And yeah. When I noticed that yesterday, it, like, knocked the wind out of me. And I was just like, oh, fuck. This is how you fucking do it. Like, this is a film made, sure, there's a white male lead. Every single person who surrounds him, supports him, loves him, everyone he has, it just... they're all people of color. Mm-hmm. Everyone in the bar, when he looks around and observes, is a person of color. The artist is a person of color. The only real interaction he has that's not a person of color is the little girl. That's mm-hmm. it. I'm just like, oh my God, I love this so much.
Some of the bus patrons that actually have speaking roles are white, though.
But he doesn't interact with them.
No, you're correct.
the very last scene in the film shows a level of the film's success, I think, and what it was trying to do. It's the first time we don't follow Patterson when he gets out of bed, because we don't have to. We know what he's going to do. We know where he's going. Nothing about the interruptions in his life over the last few days have thrown him off course. We know he puts his watch on. He's getting out of bed. We know he's going to grab the clothes off of the chair. He's going to go. He's going to eat his Cheerios. He's going to put on his jumpsuit. He's going to grab his lunchbox. He's going to walk to the... Like, we know what's going to happen because they instilled this in us. And seeing him after the fucked up weekend that he had, get up, put on his watch, get out of bed, and go, knowing what's about to happen, gives this sense of he's going to be okay. And it's such a nuanced way to answer an unasked question. Mm. And I just got chills all up and down my whole body, because it's just like, that's the film's success in a nutshell. Mm. You've built such a knowledge, an intimate knowledge of this character over 2 hours, where without a word being spoken, you know he's going to be all right.
What was that meme I showed you the other day? There's two kinds of people. One who can extrapolate data from previously given information, and then it just stops there.
Yeah. That's not quite what it is, but it's right around there, yeah.
What was your least favorite part?
My least favorite part, I really love...
What?
This is where we're different. I really love all of the conversations that Patterson gets to overhear on the bus as he drives, apart from one. There's a single lull in this film for me, and it's during the conversation of the two ridiculous teenage, quote-unquote, anarchists on the bus.
College kids.
They're not cute or funny. They're lame and cringy, which might be the point, but I don't like them, and I don't like that part. It's the only part that I wish wasn't in the movie.
I feel that way about all of the bus conversations.
Which is ridiculous. I mean, you do you, Boom, but I just, I find so much value in the other ones. I also love Patterson's reactions as he listens. That's what led me to write the question, how the fuck do you smile without moving your face? Because it's so subtle. Anyway, what's your least favorite part?
Perhaps obviously, but probs when Patterson and Laura come home to find his shredded secret notebook. I've lost work for stupid reasons, and it's heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
If I were to think too hard about the scene, I'd probably start to cry.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
What was your favorite part?
When Patterson meets the young poet, and she reads him the poem about rain, for so many reasons. First and foremost, because I love the poem that she reads for him, and the last line never fails to give me chills. Also, I really admire the way that this scene shows Patterson for what he truly is, and that is a poet and an artist. He doesn't speak to this child condescendingly or humor her in regards to her poetry. He respects her, listens to her, and reflects on her poems even later. You almost sense him absorbing her words into himself so that he can grow as an artist. He learns from her. I also really like that he points out some things, like there, you know, the first two lines rhyme. There are some nice internal rhymes in her poems, because we get a glimpse into the fact that he's not just freeballing here. He actually has some technical and stylistic knowledge as well. Like, this is something that he does. This is a craft of his. There are just so many brilliant things about this scene that I adore to pieces.
Yeah. Perhaps the part where Patterson is hanging out with the little girl. Which obviously contains my favorite poem. The scene itself just feels very genuine, mm-hmm. especially on the part of Adam Driver as he's interacting with the girl. Like, I believe that's how he would react as a real person, not just as this character in a situation like this.
Yeah, I love it so much.
It doesn't seem scripted. It seems like the director sat them down. It's like, this girl's going to read you a poem. Go.
Yeah.
So.
No, it's nice to meet a real poet. I love that line so much. Just because he seems to mean it. The character does too. Like, he's complimenting her, but also, like, I love the fact that he learns from this child and her poetry, and it's just so pure. I hate people who are snobby about their art and condescending to others. And it's just such a beautiful moment. And you can tell it's a beautiful moment for her, too. Just, like, she's so fascinated by him and interested in him. Just, like, do you like Emily Dickinson? You know, he mentions that, yeah, she's a favorite of his. And just, like, a bus driver who likes Emily Dickinson. Cool. And it's just, like, a moment for her. And it's a moment for him. And he brings it up later. And just, like, they're so, oh, God. Fuck. Damn it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What'd you rate it?
I rated it an 8. What'd you think I was going to rate it?
I had no idea. Especially at the beginning. Like, at the beginning of this, I had no idea. By the time we got to the end, I was like, it might be stronger than I initially thought.
I mean, yeah, it's well written. It's it's very, very well acted, and it's pretty to look at. There are a lot of strong points for a movie that puts me to sleep.
God damn it.
And that's not a, it's not inherently a bad thing. You
right, I know
that this isn't my kind of movie at all. But it's not a bad movie. It's a really, really good movie.
Yeah.
Aside from watching it with his other two films, I don't know when I would personally watch it again.
Yeah.
Except maybe to, like, I wish I should just compile some of the scenery shots into my own video and I can just, like, play that. Like, look up as I'm working.
Well, we own the movie, so yeah. You can watch it whenever you would like.
Yeah. So, yeah.
This is one of those where I struggled. Like, I sat and I struggled and I thought, and I'm like, I'll put a thing, I'll talk about it. I think after talking and reflecting, it's I'm going to put it at about a half a point higher than what I initially thought.
I almost put it at, like, a 7.
Interesting.
I was just like, no, this is a well-crafted movie.
Yeah. I think after, like, kind of batting back and forth with you a little bit and just talking more, it's the character that does it for me. And really the only flaw, it's the one tiny scene that I would cut out. And it is the fact that I love this movie. I could watch this movie a multitude of times, and I have. We bought it, even though it's available on Amazon. I wanted it. There are times where I've come across it because I just, you know, I type in Adam's name in Amazon because I want to watch an Adam Driver movie, and I'm just like, not right now, because I can't with this film right now. That being the only thing is sometimes I'm not in the mood to watch this particular movie doesn't seem like a very big criticism, because like I said, this movie sticks with me for days. The vibe of it, the feel of it, the sadness over the fact that this person doesn't exist. I really am having a hard time between, honestly, just between like a 9 and a 9.5 for me. Because those flaws don't seem like they should knock a whole ass point off.
Half a point?
Yeah. Well, no, just a whole ass point. That's why I'm probably leaning towards a 9.5 instead of a 9. 9.25 for Patterson. She's shaking her head. I'm not allowed to do that.
I'll go with the
9.5.
It's your podcast.
Because there's just that one scene that I don't like. And there's just that I don't like the kids. That's it. It has nothing to do with the main plot. I love everything else about it. Like, you take that scene out and this is a perfect film. For me. The only difference between this and a 10, like, I will watch Moonlight at the drop of a hat, no matter what mood I'm in, where I'm at, who's with me, fuck all y'all, yep. I'll watch Moonlight right fucking now. This, sometimes I pause, and I'm like, I can't carry this with me today. I can't watch Patterson today. But, yeah, I fucking love this movie. And still, even after reading articles and articles and articles, I want to dissect it. Like, I want to cut it to pieces because it's almost like nobody can exactly, precisely explain why it's so good and enrapturing and just kind of magical. Because it's a movie about a bus driver
who writes poems. It's literally a slice of life movie broken down day by day.
Yep. It's so lovely. It's just great filmmaking and writing and acting and... Ugh, God. I feel the sense of catharsis after talking about this movie fucking finally. It's been on the list forever. So.
Can't wait for next week. I've only watched that movie once.
And I've never seen it, so I'm really excited.
But you like Will Poulter, so.
I do. And this is a little baby Will Poulter.
Yeah. Cute. I mean, it's a coming-of-age movie. You'll probably love it.
Probably. I'm excited.
I'm pretty sure it's decently high rated.
And then gotta sit down and figure out what episodes are gonna look like for animated films.
It can't be that different.
Yep.
I think it's just gonna be
cinematography versus
cinematography and editing are gonna be a little weird because you still have those for animated movies.
It's just different, mm-hmm. like you said. I'm gonna be a mess because I don't know how to talk about animated films.
It's just a different medium. It's the same thing. It's still a movie. It's still people telling a story.
I understand. Just, like, that part's fine. It's going to be like the two things that you just said. The cinematography. Talking about the cinematography and editing.
It's the same thing.
I mean, how do I talk about lighting in an animated film?
We'll talk about it.
Exactly.
We'll talk about it.
Anywho, is your tea gone?
It's been gone.
Mine's been gone, too.
That's never happened.
I know. I was done like midway through, which is perfect because it's 10:37 and I have homework and I was exhausted before this, but that black tea did the trick.
Oh, man, I wanted to play some more games. Probably not going to happen because I'm pretty tired.
Well, or sleep. All right.
My switch to the bed.
There you go. Where can they find us?
You can find us on Twitter.
That's
Green Tea Pod.
You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/greenteapodcast.
You can find us on the interwebs, the internet, the World Wide Web at greenteapodcast.com.
Wow, you went full on World Wide Web. You can find us. Can't. You can speaketh to us via the email at thescreenteapodcast@gmail.com.
Wow.
Maybe.
Wow.
Who you blessing? Who Kevin blessing?
I know who you're blessing.
I don't know. It might depend on who you're blessing.
Oh, well, fuck it.
Oh, well, fuck it. Kevin bless. No.
Kevin press. I can't say your name.
Oh, no. You're going to make me choose between...
The actress who plays Laura.
I'm going to be struggle bussing here now for realsies.
Sorry. You're the one who said it, and if I say it, it'll just be blah, blah, blah.
No, I'm not saying this. You're going to make me struggle between who I'm going to bless. I was counting on you.
It's that or the DP, but I think she did a phenomenal job.
Yeah, okay. So you are Jules' blessing. Kevin is blessing for Jules. Bull Shifta Farahani.
Yes. There can be an honorary Kevin Bless this episode.
Didn't I have one last episode?
No, you talked about it.
I think I talked about knowing who I was going to bless this week.
You talked about knowing who we were both going to bless this week.
I thought you were going to bless the DP.
That would be the honorary. That would be the honorary.
So.
Kevin Bless. And yeah. I think I partly did that because you said you were going to do that. You said I was going to do that. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh.
I have to Kevin bless Adam Driver.
Yeah, I knew it.
But I was really struggling between him and Jim Jarmusch because this is brilliantly written and Patterson, the character, wouldn't exist.
I was gonna say we could cover Only Lovers Left Alive, but then I would have to Kevin bless Tilda. We haven't done a movie with her, have we?
Tilda?
I thought maybe.
I mean, Doctor Strange, we talked about her. That's probably what you're thinking. You know, without the writer and director, obviously we wouldn't have the film, and obviously we wouldn't have this character, but even if this film and character existed, without Adam, it would not have...
Yeah.
It wouldn't have hit as hard.
It's the combination.
You got it. So, the dream team.
Sure.
Yeah. just Kevin Bless fucking movie. Thanks. Okay, so... One more in November. Uno mas.
Yeah.
And then it's December of hell year. Good God.
Man, being 30 was shit.
Oh yes, happy birthday to our Miss McCurry here.
Yeah. Hopefully 31's better.
Yeah, it better be. No pressure. All right, folks, stay safe and just, you know, be safe for the holidays and make good choices.
Yeah, goodbye.
Bye.